It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, that quirky observer of the human comedy, Joe Queenan, brings us his England. It's a place of people driven by good-natured insanity, where home cooking thrives and the steak and kidney pie requires a pneumatic drill. His book is Queenan Country, a reluctant Anglophile's pilgrimage to the mother country. Well, the Stearns are into endangered species, chipped beef on toast at the Blue Bend Diner in Vermont. Wine maverick Josh Wesson talks the next wine wave, champagne in a can, go cups, and wine in a box. Sally Schneider says, treat your cornbread like an Italian and your polenta like a Southerner, then it's our take on the makeover. Move over, Botox. The fountain of youth is in your spice drawer. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Suvete rive e menta nouse, harja katso maahan viitimä, ei mennän viljaa kun ei tuskihin tulisi. Manu tarmaan ementä nostele, oras okinen kannon karvanen ylennä, kun ei tuskihin tulisi. Syöttele metisin syömin juottele, metisin juomin mesi heinin herkuttele, vihan nällä mättä hällä.
Kun ei tuskin
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today, America's self-appointed arbiter of taste, writer Joe Queenan, takes on the food in England. Where to find the native gems, including Joe's all-time favorite doorstop, the steak and kidney pie. His book is Queenan Country, a reluctant Anglophile's pilgrimage to the mother country. That enlightened wine guy, Josh Wesson, talks the latest wave, lifestyle vino, like champagne in a can with a straw. Down with facelifts, up with oregano. That's Health Authority Nina Simon's message, how to fight the sags from the spice shelf. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, you know that Michael and I know the way from Connecticut to Vermont very well. It seems like we're in Vermont every weekend. And this time, we stopped at the Blue Bend Diner in Bennington, Vermont, which has been there forever. And for some reason, Michael and I have always driven by it and said, next time. Well, I am so glad we stopped there because we had some wonderful food.
What do they do?
Well, they do everything that a diner ought to do. Uh-huh. I mean, they have these wonderful breakfasts. They have, you know, blueberry pancakes with real maple syrup. They make donuts to die for. I mean, real New England cake donuts. I mean, substantial donuts. And they have, you know, three meals a day, meatloaf and mashed potatoes, in addition to some sort of Nouvelle diner stuff. For example, you can get vegetarian enchiladas if you want, or
it is Bennington.
That's true. So it's got all the classic diner fare as well as kind of international dishes, vegetarian dishes.
I like the Old Vell cuisine there better. I mean, I was just amazed by the fact that they served not only Indian pudding for dessert, but it's a primordial cornmeal and molasses samp, which do you know what I'm talking about?
I've only heard the word, but I don't think I've ever had a samp, so you're going to have to explain it.
Okay. No, Michael, you explain it. You're better at that than I am.
Well, it's a hot grain cereal, and that's what Indian pudding basically is. And of course, what Jane and I did, we stopped there at breakfast time, and normally Indian pudding is considered dessert, mm-hmm. but there's no reason Indian pudding should not be breakfast. I mean, it's warm cornmeal and molasses cereal. We, of course, had it with ice cream on top, which may not fit the breakfast profile, but you can't have Indian pudding without ice cream.
And we also had something on the menu called crunchberry pancakes with turkey hash on the side. And Michael, I don't remember why they were crunches.
Well, they're crunchberry because of that little Nouvelle thing seeping in. It's granola in the pancakes, but it really is sort of a good thing to do with pancakes. It's granola and several kinds of berries. And with the turkey hash on the side, that was a really full meal.
The other thing you can get here, which is just to me just mind-boggling and show-stopping, is you can actually get cream-chipped beef on toast, which I don't think I've ever seen in real life. I think I've only seen it in movies about the Army in the 1940s.
Yeah, you know, you're right. And the chipped, I always wondered what the chipped beef was. I pictured some sort of leathery piece of beef that you took slivers off of and
well, that's kind of
dried in the
sun. Too far off. It's like a softened beef jerky that's kind of shredded. But it's been kind of reconstituted and served with this heavy, thick white cream gravy over toast. And it is, to say the least, very rib-sticking.
And I have to say that in this particular place, it is so appropriate because we haven't mentioned that the diner itself is a real classic. I mean, it's an old monitor roof, you know, the curved roof diner with a counter and stools. And if you look at the counter, I love this. If you look at the counter, on the either side of every stool is a place where the formica has rubbed smooth from years of elbows resting on it.
You ate breakfast. You didn't go back for lunch or dinner, I gather.
We're planning to.
No, next time we have to go and have more cream. I can't say cream chip beef on toast. That is a real
thing. Say SOS, Jane.
Right, or something on a shingle.
Ah, yes. Thank you both.
Okay, bye.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern made the food world jealous with their now classic road food. Everybody wishes they had thought of it first. Now, you get to hear the Sterns first here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, go for a little balance. From chipped beef on toast to a meatless recipe for cannellini beans with roasted peppers and kale. Now, there is only one way to get this quick supper recipe. You gotta sign up for our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to eat well on weeknights. Each week, we email you a quick supper recipe, and we send along shopping and technique tips. But best of all, it's free. So register for it online, splendidtable.org. Joshua Wesson is a sommelier and wine writer who saw the light. He went from convincing customers a $100 bottle was a mere bagatelle to tracking down bargain wines the world over. Now, Josh is creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops and our wine maverick who checks in every month with his new finds. Hey, Josh, good to have you back.
It's good to be had anywhere.
Well, what have you been pondering lately?
Well, it's not so much pondering as I've been drinking on the cheap lately. I've been drinking wine out of boxes, wine in cans. It sounds crazy, but even wine out of a bendy straw. And this wasn't a bendy straw that I bought. This was a bendy straw that came packaged with the wine. So I think we're on the cusp of a new wave of looking at wine, which is to sort of treat it like any other beverage that can go anywhere. You know, put it in a go cup and drink it wherever you want.
So with a straw, do you swirl? Do you sniff?
You make those sounds just, I mean, it's exactly like drinking a Diet Dr. Pepper, except, of course, it costs more and it makes you happier than Diet Dr. Pepper. The two wines that I've seen lately packaged with straws are both sparkling wines. One comes from France, one comes from California, but they're both wonderful, great fun. In fact, the producer that started this whole straw wine thing was Piper Heitzig, the champagne producer in Champagne.
Hey, they're very serious people.
They are serious, but they saw an opportunity for people walking around in nightclubs who didn't want to carry tall flutes of champagne that they'd spill over their little black dresses and open shirts. So they created what they called Baby Piper. This 187 milliliter, like the mini bottles that you see in a mini bar.
Right.
And packaged it with a straw, and it is the next big thing. It's everywhere. You go to a club and you see people drinking it. It's nuts. And it's good, of course, because Piper's good champagne.
Well, yeah,
and the folks out in California at Nibaum Coppola saw an opportunity there. And this is Francis Ford's winery.
Right, right.
And he's no slouch when it comes to creativity and marketing. And he made a sparkling wine from Pinot Blanc and Sauvignon Blanc and Muscat, which he called Sophia in honor of his daughter.
Oh, yeah.
And they put it in a little can instead of a bottle, which is even cooler than the Baby Piper. And you pull the pop top off, and they package it with a bendy straw. And I love bendy straws.
So this is sort of the direct, you get right to the bottom of that glass. You don't waste any time on nose and all of that kind of stuff.
You know, if you listen closely, when people are drinking these, it sounds like, you know, a scene from Happy Days. Everybody is finishing their malted and then going on to the burger. But these wines are representing a legitimate crest of a wave, I think, to make wine more accessible. Can you imagine if pizzerias had to sell pizza without cutting it up in slices, if you had to buy the whole pie, nobody would eat pizza. But because you can buy it by the slice, it's one of the most popular foods in the world. Well, the day that the wine industry realizes that you package wine in individual servings, I think is the day that we move an order of magnitude closer to being a wine-drinking country.
Well, now I realize there's a logical leap here. The juice box becomes the wine box.
Yeah, and in fact, that's exactly what's happened with wine boxes. And I'm not talking about little juice boxes, even though they're on the way.
Uh-huh.
But big boxes that hold 2, 3, 4 bottles of wine that have been hugely popular. They were perfected in Australia and then brought to Europe. And now 40% of the wine that's sold in Australia comes in a box. 30% of the wine that's sold in Norway comes in a box.
40%?
I know, it's staggering, but it makes sense because these boxes have these little taps, and once you open them, they don't allow air in, they just allow the wine out, and they're really perfect if you're going to drink wine every day, and you don't want to worry about any waste, and you don't need great wine to have with your burger or your chicken fried steak or, mm-hmm. or just a bowl of potato chips.
So who's doing the good stuff in the box?
Well, the wines are coming from all over the world, as you'd expect, because there's a lot of wine in the world that's just dying to get into boxes. My favorites come from different places. I like what's happening in California. In Napa, they're actually making Napa-designated black box wine. They call it black box.
Mm-hmm.
It comes in a 2-liter format. That's 4 bottles. Sells for about $25 or $30. So you're spending, you know, $5, $6 a bottle.
Right.
And you're getting Napa, Chardonnay, and Merlot, which is completely credible, completely delicious to drink. And it doesn't go bad. You can let it sit in the refrigerator or on your kitchen counter for weeks, and it'll taste as good in the fourth week as it did in the first week.
Yeah, no air. Where else? Where else do you like wines?
Well, Australia, of course. You know, they live to drink and drink to live, and they love wine in boxes. And my favorite right now is coming from Hardy's. They make a wonderful Shiraz, which sells for, I can't believe this, $18 for the equivalent of 4 bottles.
That's,
I mean, it's even a Scrooge
than Dr.
would have
Pepper.
To. Oh, God, it's just, it's phenomenal. And it's spicy and fruity. And if you're having a party, you're having a barbecue, you know, take a box like this, or, you know, you can't lose with these wines. They are guaranteed to make you happy. Even Target is selling a boxed wine now for about $16. Andrea Immer helped Target find this wine that Trinchero is making, the guys that brought you Sutter Home White Zin, but this is a whole lot better. And also a fabulous deal and very, very tasty.
This is great. Hey, Josh, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Josh Weston is co-creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. Now, you can find his box wine picks on the website, splendidtable.org. You know, another reason to go for box wine is for cooking. I don't know how many times I've wanted maybe a quarter of a cup of red for a recipe, and I haven't opened the bottle because it was going to go to waste. Now, box wines solve that problem. Because there's no air, they hold up. And most of them work out to costing about $4 a bottle. Now, for the quality that Josh talked about, that's a steal. Coming up, Joe Queenan takes on English food and beating Botox with the spice cabinet. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by SuperTarget, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too, online at target.com/supertarget. One of my favorite quotes from Joe Queenan's new book, Queen in Country, A Reluctant Anglophile's Pilgrimage to the Mother Country, is when he says, and this is the quote, "I'm not sure if English people are in fact more interesting than Americans, but the country is so small, it has encouraged the citizenry to retreat inside their heads and to cultivate a kind of good-natured insanity." Social commentator and best-selling author Joe Queenan has traveled England with his British wife for 25 years, but for this book, he plumbed the mysteries of England alone. Joe, welcome back.
Thank you.
So, Joe, why this trip without your wife?
When you live with someone from a foreign country, you always see the country through their eyes. But more to the point, you're always going to visit people named Annie Margaret or Annie Brenda or Annie Edie and Cousin Robin. And wonderful as they were, I found that we kept going to the same places to see the same relatives, and we never got to places I really wanted to go to. Like, I wanted to go to Liverpool, and I wanted to go to Scotland, and I wanted to go to Penzance, and because my wife doesn't have any relatives there, we never went to visit them, so I just went by myself.
Well, you talk about the good-natured insanity.
Yes.
How does it play into the food in England?
Well, I think that that there has been a revolution in cuisine in Great Britain in the 30 years that I've been going there. But I think that certainly living in New York, I would not go to anywhere to eat good food because I can get it back here. So when I go to England, food is not my main interest. But when I go out to eat, I'm interested in the kinds of food that I can't get here. And that would be things like all kinds of weird venisons with apples mixed in and strange kinds of rabbit and quail and pheasant. And also things like when you go into the local pub, which is about 700 years old, and they have these massive Gloucestershire sausages, just these gigantic sausages. That's the sort of cuisine that I look for. And of course, that's the cuisine that's traditionally associated with the British and thought of as bad food. Certainly, if you eat it every day, it's a bad idea. But if you eat it irregularly, it's kind of wonderful.
You said something to me at one point about the fact that everybody feels duty bound to comment on English food. And it occurred to me, I'd never thought about it, but you're right.
As soon as people hear that you've gone to England, they'll say, "Oh, how was the food?" And they're always looking down their nose at the food because they've been told to look down their nose at the food. And a lot of these people come from towns where the principal dining experience would be a Red Lobster or a Denny's. So they're not in a position to have that kind of snooty condescension. But I always find that very tiring when people say, "Oh, the French are so rude," or "the Germans aren't much fun. They don't have a lot of stand-up comics," or "the English food is terrible." Because a lot of times people are making that comments based on zero experience. If you go to England, if you marry an English person and you eat in English homes and you have those roast beefs and those Yorkshire puddings and those gigantic trifles and things like that, their food is fantastic. It's hearty and it's voluminous and it just warms the cockles of your heart. And it's not like French cuisine or Italian cuisine or Vietnamese cuisine, but it's some really fine eating.
Well, you know, one of the things that worries me is when I read about what's happening in food there, there's the Italian restaurants and the French restaurants and all of this. Is there any English food, any of the stuff you're talking about? I mean, is this relatively easy to find still?
I don't think it's relatively easy to find in the big cities anymore because every place that you go, you're already there. Every place wants to be like every other place. So a couple of years ago, I remember when I was in Cork in Ireland, we couldn't find any traditional Irish food, and every restaurant had a name like Jacob's Ladder or Esau's or Viridiana or something like that. And I think that's also true in England, is even if you go to rough neighborhoods in London, every restaurant has a name like Sottocinque or L'Avenir or something like that. And you have to go to the countryside to get the traditional English food. You have to go to pubs. If you go to pubs, you get that real fine traditional English food. And the other thing is, if you go to hotels on Saturdays before the rugby match starts and you go to the carveries,
uh-huh.
Those things are great. The huge roast beefs and the potatoes and the gigantic, humongous Yorkshire puddings. Those things are fantastic. And I would hate to see those things disappear from the English diet because I think they're the things that make going to England so great.
Is there, when you step off that plane, something you have got to have?
Yeah, I love steak and kidney pies. I just love steak and kidney pies because there's very little steak or kidney in the pie. You have to, you usually need a hammer to get through the pastry. And if you get through about 9 inches of pastry, which is sort of like breaking into Fort Knox, you can actually find a sort of cameo appearance by a piece of steak in there. And particularly if you get to Victoria Station about 1 a.m. and they've been sitting there all day and you get one of those home and you have to warm it up in the microwave for about 4 hours or else you'll break your crowns on them. I just love those things. Those things are just absolutely the best. You know, the whole thing about it's not to arrive that's important, it's to travel. That's the way I feel about a lot of English food. It's not really eating it so much that's important as actually just figuring out a way to eat it.
Joe Queenan, thank you for this gastronome's report on the British food scene.
You are most welcome.
Best-selling author Joe Queenan is a columnist for Smart Money and writes for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. His latest book is Queenan Country, A Reluctant Anglophile's Pilgrimage to the Mother Country. Food authority Sally Schneider rethinks ingredients. She looks at them with new eyes, tests new concepts, and reports the results here at the table. Now, Sally writes for magazines and newspapers. Her latest book is A New Way to Cook. Hey, Sally, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. Good to be back.
Hey, what have you been playing with lately?
Well, it seems like every restaurant I walked into these days is featuring something with cornmeal, and it got me thinking. Now, I've always served cornbread alongside dishes, as they do in the South. And loving Italian food, I also routinely make polenta. But somehow, I hadn't made the connection that both America and Italy use cornmeal to similar effect. That is, simple, satisfying, rustic dishes that can be main course, side dish, breakfast, dessert. Basically, what I'm saying is, polenta is Italy's cornbread. Cornbread is America's polenta. Maybe stretching it, but I don't think so. The gist is, Lynn, cornmeal is so good and so wildly compatible with a wide range of foods that it lends itself to improvisation and to mixing the cultures, as it were.
So now, give me an illustration of what you're talking about.
Okay. Basically, what it started me doing was escalating something I've been sort of naturally and unconsciously doing for years. That is, using polenta flavors in cornbread recipes or using cornbread in the way that one might in Europe or with European flavors or Italian flavors. Polenta I'll serve with dishes of the American South or even flavors of the American South. I'll give you some specific examples.
Mm-hmm.
Often I put grated Parmigiano in my cornbread. That's a classic thing to put in polenta. In cornbread, it gives a very sophisticated flavor, very different from our American Jack cheese. Or I might flavor cornbread with sage leaves and black pepper. That's also classic polenta flavoring. I serve pans of cornbread in their black iron skillet with all kinds of Italian dishes like pot roast braised in red wine or Mediterranean fish stew or seafood salad. I take slices of leftover cornbread to make great Italian-style bruschetta. Brush them with olive oil, toast them, rub them with a cut clove of garlic, and they make a wonderful base for all the usual things, roasted peppers, olive paste, and so on. You get the idea.
Yeah, and it's a great one.
It's a great one. Well, so now we flip it over, right, to the polenta.
Exactly. Going in the other direction, coming this way, is polenta, this divine cornmeal mush. Well, polenta is fabulous accompaniment to southern and southwestern style dishes, like pulled pork scented with cumin, venison chili, chicken mole, baked beans, gumbo-like seafoods. And it really makes sense, of course, because corn is something of the Americas. And polenta is a very straightforward dish that marries well with lots of flavors. So these ingredients just love each other. Polenta also loves a 7-hour French-style leg of lamb done with masses of garlic.
Mm.
You know the way you serve polenta as a main course in Italy, just with olive oil, sage, and Parmigiano?
Oh, yeah, right.
Here I might do brown butter and grated aged dried jack cheese, or caramelized onions and a fried egg, something like that.
Uh-huh. And maple syrup would probably be fabulous on polenta.
Polenta loves to be treated like they do cornbread in the South for breakfast. So it is wonderful, molded into a cake, sliced and fried in bacon drippings, for example, uh-huh, with maple syrup or honey or molasses. And it's wonderful as a porridge. We move more toward New England with heavy cream and maple syrup, brown sugar, and pecans, that sort of thing.
So tell me, what do you think is the difference then between the cornmeal you might use for polenta and the cornmeal you might use to make cornbread?
That's a great question. And the answer is, the only difference is in the grind. And what kind of grind you like is up to you. Now, cornmeals come in three grinds, fine, medium, and coarse. I find fine makes kind of a weak cornbread and a weak polenta, so I go for medium grind. The essential thing is that the cornmeal be fresh and made by a great producer. And it's easily available online, or often you'll have a local grist mill that is grinding whole corn into fabulous meals, and this is something to look out for. Of course, online there is the famous Anson Mills, which all the chefs love, which is one of the reasons so much cornmeal dishes are on restaurant menus.
Yeah.
And there's also a wonderful little mill called Nora Mill Granary, which is in North Georgia, that sells cornmeal in different grinds that is really terrific.
Anything in the supermarket we can use?
You know, again, if your supermarket happens to be carrying a whole meal grind of polenta, that's something to go for. Bob's Red Mill is a wonderful producer of grains. They have cornmeal in three different grinds, and they are making inroads everywhere. So I've found them all over the country.
Well, hey, Sally, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Food writer Sally Schneider is author of A New Way to Cook. You can find Sally's recipe for Parmigiano cornbread at splendidtable.org. And by the way, another cornmeal to look for is Justo's. I've had good luck with it. It always tastes fresh, it's organic, and it's coarse ground. Now, I get it at Whole Foods, but I think it should be in markets around the country. Justo's the name. We have our very own take on the makeover. It's painless, not to mention cheap. Cookbook author Nina Simon started researching healing foods in China. Now her research has expanded to working around the world with physicians and nutritionists from many different disciplines, including work on aging. Now, Nina says, forget the plastic surgery and the Botox. Check out those little bottles in the spice cabinet. She's written Spices of Life, Simple and Delicious Recipes for Great Health. Nina, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Nina, what should we be doing with the stuff in our spice cabinet?
Yeah, well, I think that people think a lot about cooking with them, but what many people don't know is that they're excellent for other things. For instance, Dr. Duke has written a book on anti-aging, and he suggests that you brew herbal teas. So you can take 3 to 4 teaspoons of oregano or rosemary or thyme or mint and steep it in 3 cups of water. Strain it and then drink those, you know, any of those herbs.
Uh-huh.
You could do a mixture twice a day, and that will strengthen your immune system, and it will also help you age better. And it's also the actual tea ritual of making tea, mm-hmm. and drinking it. I think it's a lovely ritual. So you breathe and you sit and you think about this wonderful herb flavored brew that you're drinking, and it does a lot of things.
I'm thinking about herb teas, and I don't think we think about these cooking herbs as being this kind of thing, this drink.
That's
okay,
funny.
So we've got thyme and we've got oregano, we've got these flavoring herbs. What else should we be using?
Well, definitely cinnamon. And I know everybody thinks of cinnamon, sticks, powdered. But cinnamon, in fact, is very exciting because it's recently been proven since this book was written, which was recently, or it was published, that cinnamon enhances the insulin level in the body. So if you, for instance, every day were mm-hmm. to sprinkle 1/4 teaspoon of powdered cinnamon on, I'm sitting here with a latte, actually,
uh-huh.
with a sprinkling of cinnamon, then you may actually prevent the adult onset diabetes. Chili peppers. Everybody thinks about the spice, but no, very few people know that chili peppers contain vitamin A and more vitamin C than a number of fruits and vegetables, that capsaicin, which is the heat and the pepper,
mm-hmm.
clears sinuses and relieves congestion. And I brewed a wonderful chili pepper tea with a teaspoon of dried chili pepper flakes,
uh-huh.
and a cup of water, boiling water, let that sit, drained it, and added a tablespoon of that chili pepper infusion to 1 cup of boiling water, and it helped me get rid of a cold, which was great. We now know that capsaicin, the ingredient, can be used topically to alleviate pain, arthritis. It's anti-inflammatory. So what we're discovering is it's very exciting. Not only are the herbs and spices in our, you know, cabinets, not only do they provide wonderful flavor, but they also give health, which is really terrific.
Nina, thank you.
It's my pleasure.
Food Authority Nina Simons is author of Spices of Life, Simple and Delicious Recipes for Great Health. Now, Nina left us with a recipe for fragrant cinnamon pork with sweet potatoes. Now, you can get it, you know where, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question comes from that book by Nina Simons. The question is, which herb has new research proving that Ophelia was right? Now, I'm talking about the famous mad scene in Hamlet. Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/supertarget. We're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question comes from Nina Simon's book on the health benefits of seasonings. Which herb has new research proving that Ophelia was right? It's rosemary. In Ophelia's mad scene from Hamlet, she hands Hamlet, her lover, who had discarded her like old socks. Anyway, she hands him a sprig of rosemary, saying, "Here is rosemary, love. It is for remembrance." Now, everyone sitting in that theater 500 years ago, seeing Hamlet for the first time, knew that rosemary was like Ophelia slapping Hamlet across the face. Rosemary was the bride's herb, the original wedding favor, so that you would remember the bride's day fondly. Ophelia knew there would never be a wedding. Well, today there's happier news. Herbal authority Jim Duke's research is showing that rosemary actually could enhance memory. He speculates it might help Alzheimer's patients. One thing's for sure, rosemary is an antioxidant, and a cup of rosemary tea a day wouldn't hurt. Well, the lines are officially open, and you can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get to the phones. We have got Kay on the line from Tallahassee. Hey, Kay, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hey, man. Thank you for letting me call you.
You are welcome, ma'am.
I am looking for what seems to be a very well-kept secret. I make ice cream. I have several ice cream makers and wonderful recipes. It turns out gooey and yummy and delicious when you make it and you eat it right away. But what is the secret when you want to keep it and put it in the freezer? It just turns to a block of ice.
Ah, all right. This is going to be called an educated guess, all right,
oh,
Kay?
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, let's put it this way. I wouldn't say that this is, you know, testament here. Does it turns into a block of ice? Does it get real crystally crunchy?
Well, it just becomes solid. It isn't like store-bought where you can put your scoop in and you can scoop it out. And
right.
It's smooth and
right,
creamy.
Right.
No matter what recipe I've made, it does the same thing. It just turns to ice.
I'll be darned, because, you know, well, you know, in the store-bought ice cream, they put in these emulsifiers and these other things to keep it creamy. But the other thing is that I find homemade ice cream tends to be harder than store-bought, but still can be quite creamy. And there's a lot of factors that makes for successful ice cream. And one of them is, first of all, not cutting back on the sugar.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Do you cut back on sugar?
Yes, I do.
Ah, that may be.
I try to cook with less sugar.
That's the problem, maybe.
Thanks.
I'll explain. This is the little bit of science I think I know about this. That when the sugar dissolves into the mixture that you make for the ice cream, right?
Yes.
It makes a sugar syrup. And there's still some other liquid out there, and that liquid freezes into little crystals. But the sugar syrup actually never freezes the same way. It's sort of what makes ice cream kind of chewy and creamy.
Really?
Yeah. It actually acts as a buffer. The other thing is you need a sufficient amount of fat, because the other thing we tend to do with ice cream recipes is cut back on the fat. Well, the fat, if you can imagine this, is one of the things that also keeps the crystals from forming. Now, the more crystals you have and the bigger they are, okay.
Right.
And that comes from reducing fat and reducing sugar. The more you're going to get ice cream that's like an ice cube. Because what happens is you've got frozen water.
And very good.
Yeah. Isn't this interesting? And it's interesting because the other thing is, always when you've made the mixture that you're then going to put in your ice cream maker, chill it for 4 to 12 hours first, that it should go in chilled. And then put it in the ice cream maker. Because sometimes people try to skip that step, and evidently that has an effect on maybe ending up with ice cream that turns into an ice cube.
Really?
Yeah. So try those three things.
I will.
I think it may help you.
Thank you.
You are welcome.
All right. Love the show. Listen to it every week.
Hey, thanks a lot. Thanks for calling.
Okay. Bye-bye.
800-537-5252. That's how you can reach us. And let's see, who is up next? We have got Stephen calling from Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Stephen, what do you want to talk about?
I wanted to put in a plug for my local radio station, which is WGBH in Boston.
Oh, great.
My real question is, hemp has now been, or at least industrial hemp, has been legalized in Canada. And I know of some applications of hemp. You can use the seeds and press them for oil.
Right.
You can grind them into flour.
Right.
You can even put them whole in cookies, sort of like you would put nuts in cookies, I guess, and things like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was wondering if there's any other uses for hemp.
Just as an interesting aside, in the research I did in rural life in the past in Italy, it was so interesting to see how many areas of Italy hemp was used instead of linen by especially people on the lower end of the economic scale, and beautiful things. I mean, sheets and lace and very luxurious looking fabrics, and they were all woven from hemp. But, you know, essentially anything that you can do with a pumpkin seed or an almond or a sunflower seed, you can do with hemp.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, because if you think about it, I mean, it's the similar kind of thing. And one thing that a friend of mine does is she takes the hemp seeds and she tosses them with a little olive oil and coarse salt and, you know, add spices and roast them in the oven and puts them out with drinks. I mean, the seed is popping up everywhere now.
Yeah.
And as you said, bread, cookies, I mean, all of that kind of thing is perfect places for it. And, you know, I'm just thinking how we use nuts. I love to throw nuts into couscous. Or, you know, into rice or over vegetables, like you'll steam vegetables and you'll put, I don't know, balsamic vinegar and a little onion on them. Imagine roasted hemp seeds over that. Hey, see what you think.
Okay, thank you.
You take care, Stephen.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. We have got, let's see, who's up next? We've got Ann calling from Minneapolis. Hey, Ann, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Well, I am calling in regards to marinating tofu. And I've recently attempted to fry it and attempted to make stir fry.
Yeah.
However, the tofu came out very heavy.
Were you using the firm? Because it comes two ways, firm and soft.
Right. Yep. I was using the firm.
And how big were you cutting it?
Like maybe half inch.
And was your oil or your pan really scorching hot?
Well, it sizzled when I dropped things into the pan. I don't have a wok. It was a regular frying pan.
Yeah, but when you stir fry anything, you really want it to be really hot.
Okay.
And in the case of tofu, because tofu is like a little sponge, God bless it, you know, it's very bland in flavor, but it will pick very delicate. That's the nice way to say it. Delicate in taste, but it'll pick up everything. But it will tend to absorb the fat if the fat's not super hot, and you kind of get it in and get it out really fast.
Okay.
Yeah. But as far as marinating,
right.
I remember a Japanese cold tofu dish where you just had a little grated ginger and very thin sliced scallions, and you had a little bit of rice vinegar and soy sauce.
Okay.
But a light, like Kikkoman soy sauce. If you can't get to an Asian market, Kikkoman's great, but avoid La Choy like the plague. It is the most vile stuff that has ever been put in a jar. You'll throw out everything.
Right.
But it's just this little teeny bit, and you chill that. It is so fresh and so, you feel pure inside when you eat it.
Okay, so is there such thing as marinating tofu too long?
I'd say a couple of hours is fine, but leaving it overnight, maybe, you know, it depends. If the marinade is very high in acid, it could break it down. But otherwise, I think you're pretty safe.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks. Hey, thanks for calling.
I appreciate it.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. 52. You know, there was a period of time when I criticized tofu and people got extremely upset. But the reality is it's been around for about 4,000 years and it can be dynamite stuff, but it begs to be complemented by other tastes. 800-537-5252. Talk to us. Let's see now. We have Terry calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, Terry, how are you? What's up? What do you want to talk about?
Oh, well, hello, Lynn. I am a big fan of dim sum.
Oh, yeah.
The little Chinese dumplings, uh-huh, and the bean curd rolls and such. But I, even at the Asian markets, cannot find the dumpling sauce. The only place I can find it is at the restaurant.
You mean the soy sauce sort of thing that you dip them in?
Yes, and it's a little bit sweet, and it has the garlic and the ginger, and I pretty much know the ingredients, but I don't know the base of it and how to get that sweet, that taste.
Generally speaking, have you tried making it?
Yes, but it just tasted like sugar and soy sauce.
Yeah. Well, generally,
I wondered if maybe it was something that you kind of, you know, like brew and get.
No. It's the easiest thing in the world. By the way, there are many different dumpling dips. You know what I'm saying? But they're all more or less in the same category. I'm going to throw out a thought to you. This is one basic. I do this now by feel, but I think these were the original measurements. Okay.
All right.
Yeah, it was a quarter cup of soy, mm-hmm, 2 tablespoons of rice vinegar, or you could use plain white vinegar, and I've been known to use cider vinegar. Okay.
Okay.
A teaspoon of very finely minced ginger. And 2 teaspoons of sesame oil. You know, that's the roasted sesame oil.
It's the
rate. That's great.
How much did you say?
About 2 teaspoons.
Oh, that's a lot.
Well, yeah, but you want that sesame taste. And then you want sliced scallion and a little chili and sugar to taste. But add the sugar after you get everything else together. And that way you have control. And those are the basic elements. It's the sesame oil, which you can decrease or increase. It's always the soy sauce. It's always the rice vinegar. It's always a bit of that ginger.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
You see.
And what about garlic?
Garlic can go in there, too. A small clove minced.
Right.
Very fine. Really fine. And then the chili and the sugar are you due to taste. Some people leave the chili out entirely. And they just do a little bit of the sugar.
Well, I've had it a little bit spicy, and I've had others where it's just so aromatic, and I could just drink it like a soup.
I know. And usually when you have dim sum that has pork inside of it or very robust flavors, mm-hmm, or dim sum that comes from parts of China that's traditional in areas where chili is used, that's when you get the chili in it. Often you don't get the chili in it if the dim sum is coming from places where chili generally isn't used, or if the dim sum is really delicate. But since you're making it for you, you make it any way you want, and you mix it with anything you like. You can dip anything into it.
Yeah, I think it has dumplings down fine, but I always kind of go to the restaurants and take a little extra of their sauce.
And steal it and take it home, yeah. Certain other people have been known to do things like that, too. How else are you going to know if you've got it right?
Yeah.
But it gets so messy when it spills in your bag. Hey, thanks, though.
Well,
I think a lot of people are going to like trying this.
I'll come up with it eventually, and thank you.
You are welcome. Just remember, play with those balances.
All right.
Okay?
Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you. Bye. Well, you know, learning how to feed yourself and your family is a big issue today, especially for people who've rarely had a home-cooked family meal. There's almost no experience to build on. And that's the challenge facing Betty Wilson of New York's Fortune Society, which helps rehabilitate ex-convicts. Betty runs Miss Betty's Practical Cooking and Nutrition class, and she's on the phone. Betty Wilson, welcome.
Thank you.
So explain to me what you're doing.
Well, the mandate that I was told when I was first brought on board here at Fortune just over a year ago was that we were going to work with young fathers, and they're all in a program called Alternative to Incarceration,
mm-hmm,
and they wanted to bring a healthier way of eating into their lives. So the question is, how do you interest people? I mean, with the title like nutrition class, believe me,
yeah,
that is an immediate turnoff. So what I do is it's in a total immersion in preparing a meal. So they come in and we immediately start chopping and washing, and I usually lay out a lot of fresh vegetables and on the table, and the vehicle that I'm using to get more vegetables and fruits to this population is salad. That's my vehicle.
Right.
So I always lay out lots of different kinds of salads on the table and other vegetables and whatever we're making that day, just a pretty display of food on the table. And we just start preparing it. And then when we're done, we set up a buffet, and it's attractively presented because I, you know, pick up serving dishes and yard sales and things like that.
Right,
and
right.
Or buy them.
Mm-hmm.
And we lay out a nice buffet, and then people eat, and we sit down and eat together, and we talk.
So what do you want them to, is this a one-time experience?
No, they stay in the class about 8 weeks, sometimes a couple times longer. But it's about an eight-week class, and we meet 3.5 hours on Thursday.
Now, most of these people have been in the prison system, right?
Yes, they have.
And most of them are coming from backgrounds where cooking for your family is not going on very much.
Well, yes, that's true. And it's more than that. It's what do you do with the cooked food? For example, people have pots of food on the stove, and I don't know, people go up and get it, and they drag a TV tray in front of the television, and that's how a lot of people eat. So at first I had a good bit of resistance to setting the table. Why do I need to learn to put the fork, you know, on the left? What difference does that make to me? I just pull up a TV tray. But just sitting down to eat together is a family time, and I think this course is about a lot more than nutrition and practical cooking. It's also about making home,
mm-hmm.
and that's the experience that a lot of the guys haven't had. Sitting down at the table with the family and eating together, talking together, preparing food, and, you know, using fresh ingredients that's the thing they haven't done very much of.
So has there been any follow-up to see if this has had any effect on their lives?
Well, I have to say they come in. I mean, I've had so many of the guys come in and say, wow, I made that meatloaf or the garlic spaghetti or the pot roast at home, and my family just loved it, and they're proud. They got a lot of praise for that, and they also, you know, put something good out there, and I don't know if they're all sitting down at the table, but some of them are, and that is making a big difference.
Well, Betty Wilson, thank you.
You're welcome.
Betty Wilson is with the Fortune Society. Now, you can find more information on this project on our website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this quote from Albert Einstein. He said, "An empty stomach is not a good political advisor." Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. Register for it online at splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper.
American Public Media.